I'll see you later tonight.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Henry Ford Community College gift cards are a great way to show your support for someone in your life who is seeking the skills necessary to fulfill their dreams. Available in values from $10 to $100, gift cards can be used towards payment of tuition, purchasing books and supplies, lab fees, or even a lunch at Skylight Cafe. Gift cards can be purchased at the campus bookstore or online at collegestore.hfcc.edu. College gift cards. What better way to encourage a student in your life than with an investment in their future?
Hey, this is Stone Perkins. Join me Saturday nights from 8 until 10 p.m. for Five Gears in Reverse. It's all here. Punk, blues, indie ska, garage, and a whole lot more. So remember, Five Gears in Reverse. Saturday nights from 8 until 10 p.m. And you can only find it right here on WHFR Dearborn.
Yeah.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students. The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves, WHFR.fm. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to whfr@hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m.
My pet owl is a virtual owl. She lives on a video screen. And when I select her hooting mechanism, she hoots. Basically, she's always awake. I mean, she's only awake at night. I mean, owls are nocturnal, but it is always nighttime on her screen. I mean, the screen behind her is black to indicate night, and her eyes are always open, so yeah. Maybe one day I'll catch her with her eyes closed. Who knows? Owls are nocturnal. I know this because my pet owl came with a book about owls. It's just called Owls: The Facts. And it's written by Joyce James, who is probably not a real person. My pet owl is a predator, but her eyes are stuck in her head and they can't move. That's authentic. That's how it is. So the only way for my pet owl to scan for prey is to swivel her head around 360 degrees, which she does when I move my fingers over the sensitive pad. I keep moving my finger over the sensitive pad and making my owl turn her head around, you know, like all the way around 360. It's cool. It's like going around and around and around. Why not? You know, I paid for this thing. I wish my pet owl could hunt, you know? I mean, let me check the book here at Dex Hunting. Oh, here we go. The owl hunts for small rodents, insects such as moths. No. No, dude, these are just facts about hunting. God. I want to know if my pet owl can literally swoop off her branch and kill something, like a mouse. I want to see a mouse get killed! What a rip. The only reason I bought this thing was because I wanted a great pet, a powerful pet. More than a pet, a partner. I thought an owl would make a great partner, because owls are powerful. She looks so real. I'm starting to feel like there's a real bond between us. Yeah. Yeah, I feel it. Animal to animal. I'm starting to think my pet owl, like, gets it, you know? There's a real owl in there. I know it. She's real, and she's powerful, and she wants to come out and fly over the forest and swoop down and stab a mouse in the face and eat it. I know she wants to be my forest partner. I'm Sarah Silverman, and today I got a virtual owl. If what you're looking for is a virtual pet, I'd recommend that you think about it. And if you need something to do while you're thinking, how about you could listen to episode 3 of The Organist, the podcast of The Believer magazine and KCRW.
As Sarah Silverman pointed out, you're listening to The Organist, a monthly internet radio show brought to you by KCRW and KCRW.com. This is episode 3, which serves the greater month of April, and features, among other things, a conversation between Jack White and Conan O'Brien, who extemporizes a new chapter in Frankenstein fan fiction. We'll also hear a conversation between the painter Laura Owens and the writer Rachel Kushner, whose new novel, The Flamethrowers, is out this month. I have a cold. We'll also hear about an EP of dance music composed entirely of the anxieties of real teenagers. We'll hear a reconsideration of The Blob, plus an album of superlative hillbilly music that the curator of the Alan Lomax Archive found in a dumpster in Louisville, Kentucky. But before any of that happens, let's hear from our executive producer, Ross Simonini.
Shane Carruth makes the kind of films you want to watch repeatedly. His 2004 film, Primer, was a time travel film so subtle and sly, it never mentions the words time travel. Now, about 10 years later, he's releasing Upstream Color. It's the story of a life cycle of an organism that moves from plants to worms to humans. It focuses on a specific couple, a man and a woman played by Carruth and Amy Simetz, who get caught up in this life cycle and form a strangely intimate relationship with the book Walden by Thoreau. It's hard to talk about the film, and there isn't a whole lot of dialogue. Instead, sound design carries a lot of the story. Earlier this year, the film won an award at Sundance for its sound design. I interviewed Carruth about his thoughts on sound editing.
Walden, the book, it becomes the sort of the rough material that the film plays with. Everything that has to do with light and sound and beasts and soil and even worms and things that are just very of the natural world, they become, every time the characters come in contact with these things or we see them as the audience, they need to be heightened in some way to sort of define that this is a presence that's happening. I mean, we throw light behind characters as a halo over their shoulder because they've had some experience with light. So in the same way, sound has got to do that too. It's got to punctuate because it's not just happening for us to know that leaves are rustling. It's happening for us to know that the character is somehow affected by the sound of leaves rustling.
My husband replied his wife.
Do you hear that?
And what?
There's a sound coming from underneath the house.
There's so much that's unsaid in the film, and you know we need a way to talk about that. When we have two characters that are linked somehow, and they don't even have a way to speak to that, one of the ways we can do that is if they're both droning on with lost in sound, lost in the same types of sounds and sounds from the natural world coexisting with sounds from a corporate world or business modern world. Like the way that they go together, that's one of the only tools that are allowable in the story to show that there's a link there. Because if it wasn't, we would have to talk about it, and we can't talk about it because they can't talk about it.
It's an old house. There's 9 things in this house that sound like that.
Can you just go in there?
I'm gonna go in there.
I haven't slept
Thank
at
you.
All.
Come on.
I haven't slept at all. I'm sorry. I really. You don't believe me? I'm not lying. Can you hear?
I may have. I think I'm. There's a weird flowing sound.
I chose Walden mainly because I thought of it as a non-narrative narrative. Like, I really thought of it as boring and pretentious and didn't have much going on other than, you know, some people thought it was interesting to be isolated in the woods. And that, I mean, that was my experience reading it in high school. And so I used it because I thought, well, if I was going to put, you know, in the film, there is, without giving away too much, there is, this book is used in conjunction with putting somebody under a state of suggestion or making them open to suggestion. And so I thought, well, this is pretty good because this certainly wouldn't wake them up out of any kind of a spell. It would be the kind of thing they just sort of wouldn't think about as they learn these words.
Remember when the shutter is wholly removed.
The finest qualities of our nature.
Like the bloom and fruits can be preserved.
The stream flowing out in that direction through a wooded valley.
The stream there was none.
I am glad to have drunk water so long.
You know, we've got a character that's sampling sounds. He goes out and he'll create a a stack of bricks, like a tiny brick wall, and he'll push it over and capture the sound of that collapse, and then, you know, slow down that sound. So, I mean, that's literally, we're out there while we're shooting, we're capturing that sound, and then, you know, bring it up in a piece of software and manipulate it that way. There's a lot in the music, though, that is, like when we were shooting at the pool, you know, the pool had a very specific hum to it, and under, you know, I was underwater with the camera, so I actually have sounds from underwater. While we're recording, so I would take some of that, and that's been manipulated, and that's actually in the score. There are instruments that are based on, you know, some of the underwater samples. I'm hopeful that there's a lot being communicated non-verbally in this film. I've enjoyed a lot of foreign films that I don't necessarily have subtitles for. You can get a sense of who knows what when and what they would like out of this, and, you know, where the tension lies. You get all these things, even if you don't know every syllable that's being spoken. You know, I lived by myself a long time in the suburbs in Dallas, and so I basically just would have, like, a living room that was nothing but a TV that was on, and I would write. And I would screw around with music and screw around with other things, and I just lived in isolation forever. And so those would be like my screensaver I'd have on the TV. I'd have like Viva Savi or just anything with the, because if it was an English language film, it would be too distracting. But since I don't understand the foreign, I could just, you know, put that up there. And we reach a point where the music is only subjective. It's talking about the emotional experience of the characters at that moment and not what the audience is meant to think. You know, I mean, you could play some very suspenseful music, and so the audience is supposed to think that, you know, a monster is supposed to jump out or whatever. But there's just the difference between narrating through music what the story is and narrating through music what the experience of this character we're looking at is happening and that's how it typically works. But it's also, I think, because of that, it can be very subversive, because I think, like, the way this movie ends, we are looking at something that the cinematography, the music, the performance, what's on screen is telling us that this is a very good thing. This ending is well resolved. And there is some, you know, some peace that's found, and it's emotionally a positive thing. But I think if you look at the text of what's happening, I don't think you could make that case at all. The text of it is incredibly sad and melancholy, I think, of where this thing ends. But so that's what I mean. It's like the music is now matching the experience of that character in that moment at that time, and it's completely subverting the actual text.
Jack White started Third Man Records to reissue out-of-print music from his band The White Stripes, and in the years since, the label has released an increasingly eclectic array of records, most of them produced by Jack White, from artists like Beck and Tom Jones, and also totally unknown quantities. Third Man also puts out an impressive array of oddity and novelty records. The most novel of the novelties that Third Man puts out is probably the Green Series, which releases 7-inch vinyl singles that traffic in non-musical ideas, featuring work by cattle auctioneers or spoken word artists. They're often accompanied by interviews with Jack White. Conan O'Brien's contribution to the Green Series is an improvised take on the Frankenstein story, accompanied by an interview with Jack White.
To bring dead flesh to life, to reanimate a rotten corpse, to breathe life into clay. It's been the dream of every man since the beginning of time. And they call me mad? I'm not mad. I'm a god among men. And they stand outside my castle with their torches and their pitchforks. Those idiots. But you, my lovely, you will show them. I will call you Benjamin. Yes, Benjamin. Not a threatening name. You will attack them. You have the strength of 30 men. You'll kill all of them, Benjamin. I'll call you Benny. Yes, that's better. Benny. So anyway, Benny, what I want you to do is there's these people outside the castle with pitchforks. You'll see them, and they're yelling about Frankenstein and such. Just go out there and rip their heads off, would you? And make this sound. That will frighten them. No, I understand that you're actually quite verbal. Well read, but just make that sound. Last time you went out and you said, excuse me, gentlemen, it's time to rip your heads off, and it didn't have the same effect. Yes, okay. So anyway, let's get it right. You go outside the castle, as you see, and start ripping your heads off and go, if a torch should get near you, just pretend to be afraid of it. I don't know why it works, it just does. Yes, I know you don't fear fire, and you love to barbecue, but just go out there and just go for it. Could you please? Appreciate it. Okay, Benny, that'd be great. Now, while you're doing that, I'm going to make us both a latte. Yes, that's right. Oh, I know you like your latte. Okay, well, you run along now. And, oh, and try and shuffle your feet and make your arms all stiff. No, I understand you do yoga. You're very supple, but just it helps the whole thing. Do you know what I'm saying? Okay, yeah, just remember, stiff arms, shuffling feet, fire bad, rip their heads off, and then come back and we'll have that latte. Just, and let me know, give me a call on your cell phone 5 minutes before you come and I'll have the latte hot. Yeah, that'd be a great idea. No, I get cell service up at the top of the tower. I'll be there. Yes, give me a call. Good man. Okay, Benny, I'll see you in a little bit. Bye-bye. What an idiot. I hate Benny.
Conan.
Yes, sir.
Cocoa,
that's right.
Conebread. Cobra.
Cobra, I've never heard Cobra.
Coney Island,
I've heard that.
The Cone Mish,
yes.
Ice cream cone.
Got it, I've lived with that one for a while.
Coffee and a scone.
No.
Cone bone,
I've heard.
Cocaine. Traffic cone, copay, co-op, colon, Conan the sexagenarian, Roach? Roach! Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yes.
Tony Danza and the Man of La Mancha.
That one, I've lived with for 8 years, that one.
Wee Conan.
Never heard that one.
That's not very good. We met a long time ago in Detroit in a bowling alley once.
That's right.
You were eating with Penn and Teller.
Yes. God, that was a long time ago. I want to say that was maybe 1999 or something.
That's right.
I shot a remote at Ted Nugent's ranch where we drove around on ATVs, fired bows and arrows into trees, and then played Catch Scratch Fever 600 times. And then I baled hay. It was the weirdest day of my life. And then Ted showed up, yeah. And said, why are you in my house, dude?
Hey, during that whole Tonight Show debacle, did anyone ever consider asking Fred the Corver to come in and straighten it out?
Well, they did, but I think he was dead. We contacted him through a spiritualist, and he said that he didn't want to get involved. And then he conceded that he was more of a Leno guy. That's when I flipped the Ouija board over and said, this is bullshit, and stormed out of the room.
Tell you to a mean Frank Gorshin impression.
I'm not sure I really do a Frank Gorshin. I'm just more, I appreciate Frank Gorshin.
Are you legally allowed to do an impression of Jay Leno? Is that allowed?
What I can do is an impression, and then I can tell you that it's my impression of rapper Ludacris. And you can decide for yourself who you think it sounds like, but this is my impression of rapper Ludacris. So, you know, anyway, my album's gonna drop in October. It's gonna be a really great album. And it's gonna, you know, so look for that in October. And then I'm gonna tour with the album for a little bit. And I think it's gonna, you know, we got a couple of guest people coming in and doing tracks on it. And I think it's gonna be it's a really good rap album. You know, I think it's
That's dead on Ludacris.
Okay. That is Ludacris. For legal purposes, that is Ludacris. But I've probably said too much. Who hears this? That's important. Is this would legal authorities ever hear this? They wouldn't hear this,
no,
would they?
It's mostly distributed on cassette in Southeast Asia.
So perfect.
Big market for you.
Perfect. And I understand this is going to be a wax cylinder. And so you would actually need one of only three existing Edison machines from 1880 to actually hear my confession of murder. So
yes,
the chances of
exactly.
me being caught. Yeah. What I fear most now is a detective with turn of the century technology. That's what it really a detective that shows up and I'm all calm and confident and cocky. You got nothing on me, copper. Oh yeah? He puts this mahogany and brass cylinder turning machine from 1885 on the table. Boom! And I'm like, oh my God. Does this sound familiar?
Very hot little lad. Her face is white as snow. It's snow. It's snow. Button up your overcoat when the wind roams free. Oh, by the way, I killed a bunch of hobos, I did. Yeah, slit their throats and threw them in an alley. Take good care of yourself. You belong to me. Holy, holy, holy.
That's my impression of...
Yeah, a murder confession on my cylinder.
Yeah.
Impression of...
That's my impression of Rudy Valley... confessing to a crime in 1911. Yeah, no one's going to believe that. They're just not going to. And the cops are so stupid, man. They're so stupid.
Well, let's take it.
They'll never catch me.
Let's take a five-minute break.
What?
Sort of get a drink of water, maybe sort of reassess why we're actually here, maybe. I think you're drifting again.
Okay. I thought I was... I've never been more on point.
We're going to close up right now. If you want to keep going, we're going to go get something to eat.
All right, you guys go get something to eat, and I'll just sort of talk about my life. Total inconsideration. Southern hospitality, my ass. Let's get that clown in here, insult him, lock him in a room on some Nashville plantation, and walk away. And then show the whole thing on the internet. It's really funny. After I built a goddamn plane... I had it built from other parts of planes and some parts of things that weren't even planes. There's a wheelbarrow in the cockpit. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. God, I'm under so much pressure to always be the best, to always look the best. What's wrong with me? Who am I talking to now? They're probably going to edit this out. I'm sure they're going to edit this out so I can speak freely. I really believe I'm gay. I mean, I'm not judging.
Conan, we're still here.
I said, I thought you went away. That's what I said.
You said something about comedians on the dark side. I kind of feel that. That's really true. Do they get pressured too much from, you know, Joe Schmo? Hey, do something funny. I mean, when you're walking down the street and nobody asks a musician to sing a song.
Right.
They want you to be funny. Or they try to impress you and make you laugh. Or something.
Yeah, my least favorite thing in the world is hearing a joke. I hate jokes. I don't like jokes.
Like
I like
story jokes, like the guy...
Yes. I don't like because they're very artificial.
They are.
And I always feel a joke is pressure. When someone's telling me...
I like that we have on tape, though, that you don't like jokes.
I don't like jokes. I mean, I do like a good, well-crafted joke. It's fun to tell. But it's not my favorite thing. My favorite thing is to conversationally...
No, you said you don't like jokes. That's what you said.
I guess my point is I don't like jokes and I don't enjoy making people laugh.
That's your point.
Yeah. And I have no emotional attachment to my children or wife. Those are the only things I wanted to make clear on this recording. And that I feel no empathy for humans.
See,
that's pretty much it.
No one told me that. That's what you wanted to accomplish.
I thought, as long as I can get out those things. I don't like jokes. I don't like to make people laugh. I find no joy in life. I have no empathy for other humans. and I can't tell the difference between a smile and a frown, and I'm just out for myself. I also think I can move the sun with my fingers. I guess if we learn anything from this recording, I'd like that to come out.
Jack White and Conan O'Brien's conversation, as well as Conan's And They Call Me Mad, is available as a 7-inch from Third Man Records. In 2003, the novelist Rachel Kushner interviewed the painter Laura Owens for the second issue of The Believer. Now, nearly 10 years later, they're back in conversation, but the tables have turned. Laura Owens, the painter, is asking the questions of Rachel Kushner, the novelist, on the occasion of the publication of her brand new novel, The Flamethrowers, which centers around a young, unnamed artist who makes her way through the New York art scene of the 1970s.
Hi, my name is Laura Owens. I live in Los Angeles. I make paintings, and I'm here with Rachel Kushner. What I found really interesting about the book is the lack of agency all these women have in trying to negotiate their world, and then how they gain agency in different ways, and like the fact that this woman is like this incredible motorcycle racer, but like goes to a dinner party and I think barely says a word. You hear her thoughts, but you don't hear her voice.
When I was young, living in New York, I felt like I didn't really have a right to speak until I had some purchase on the discourse and could sound smart. And if I didn't know a reference that somebody brought up, to interrupt their story, to ask them to explain the reference, was in a way to let them know that they shouldn't pursue anything with you beyond acquaintanceship. That's the way I felt. I hate to say it, but men do talk a lot. And I have been at these dinner parties in the art world where there are a few people that are self-authorized storytellers, and they hold court, and they assume that what they're talking about is interesting to everyone else, and there's a kind of tacit social pact that it is interesting and that they will be allowed to speak until they're finished.
Okay, so I'm a painter. I make sometimes I think about like paintings within paintings, and something that we really noticed in this book was how many stories within the novel there are. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it seems like you seamlessly weave these beautiful little stories within the story that like I find like amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't extremely deliberate about the way that I built the book with these smaller vignettes inside of it, but once I started writing them, I realized that they pertained in some way to the structure. And it partly comes back to this thing we were talking about the men do most of the talking in dialogue. They love to riff and be raconteurs and explain. And I guess that was kind of part of my own education as a young person in the art world. I liked to listen to people when they do that thing of telling their stories. And you know that they're sort of set pieces to some degree, but with a little bit of variation each time. And it's taking place in a bar, and they know when they're going to get a laugh out of it, etc. So I wanted as a writer to just sit down and make one of those, like those vignettes that people sort of tell and retell until they perfect it. And I wanted a reader to be able to see that the narrator is having that experience of being a listener in these cases where it's just different people telling the stories. And formally, it was a nice challenge for me to see if how much I can get away with before the reader goes, wait a minute, who is the narrator of this novel again?
I'm really interested in the older women you portray in the book, because there's a certain sadness to the way that they interact socially, with feeling slightly powerless but exacting a kind of power over people that is disheartening. And can you talk a little bit about that, especially in the New York scenes, the gallery owner?
Galleries occupy a very particular position because they have a lot of power over people, but it's a slightly, it can be a sort of petty type of power, and they can wield it, you know, they can just be frosty to somebody who wants something from them.
We're seeing it through the eyes of this young woman artist who's, you don't have any hope. I mean, compared to this, she's sitting next to at the dinner party, this character, John Dog, who's showing his slides under the table and, yeah, you know, is so ambitious. And obviously the gatekeepers or this sort of frostiness doesn't allow her any entry into this social world.
Well, I mean, would you say that that reflects reality to some degree in terms of what the art world is like?
Yeah, I think that there's a certain understanding that women artists are women artists. I mean, it's so exactly what it is that it's almost unable to be spoken about. Does that make any sense?
Meaning that reality is that way.
Kind of, yeah.
She's saying yes.
But, I mean, who is the one who makes the mark? You know, it's sort of this question, who can make the mark? Who can make the gesture? And it's interesting, your book sort of starts around, is taking place around this time of mediums like photography and filmmaking, really, because of, I think, of their newness and their sort of the lack of a hand mark in them allow women artists to be called the masters. So like someone like Cindy Sherman.
Or Sherry Levine.
Or Sherry Levine can be thought of as a great artist in this capacity because of this particular medium that takes the hand out. But I think we're still I think it's still, if you're talking about a certain realm of conservative ideas about art, you know, things are pretty similar to the way they were.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably true. And it's partly what makes the 70s an exciting time in New York City is that there's all this interesting work that's being made by women by the mid-70s. And a lot of it has no sellable object. You know, it's like the great era of the dematerialized form, and people are doing crawling on water towers on roofs, or dance was huge, and it's kind of more traditionally gendered female thing, dance. I mean, there's the great painter Lee Lozano, who was still working then, but she was working in a much more traditional medium and was really highly regarded by her male peers. Like, she had a solo show at the Whitney in, I think, 1971. But she was working in a milieu where it was mostly men who had the power. And I'm not saying these two things are related, but Lee Lozano, the next year, in 1972, started this project, Boycott All Women. And she stopped speaking to women for the rest of her life, 28 years, until she died. And to me, that was a sort of sad emblem of something, of sort of a woman working in a medium where she has just given up on the idea that there's going to be any equality and has dedicated herself to ignoring other women because they have no power. But I don't think that's really the case, that women had no power. There's all these great artists, and I read Yvonne Rainer's diaries from that time, Feelings Are Facts.
Mm-hmm.
And she's this incredibly interesting woman who had radical ideas very early, and pretty much pursued what she wanted to pursue and did what she wanted to do.
Listen to the entire conversation between Rachel Kushner and Laura Owens at kcrw.com/believer.
I'm Charlie White. I'm an artist. I primarily work in photography and film. And just completed a collaborative project with musician Brian Holland to realize a teen pop album titled Music for Sleeping Children.
And I'm Brian Holland. I record under the name Boom Bip. I also have a second project called Neon Neon with Griff Reese from Super Furry Animals. And I primarily make electronic experimental music, and that was my contribution to Music for Sleeping Children.
Charlie White and Boom Bip call their collaboration a teenage pop album, but it doesn't sound like Justin Bieber or Taylor Swift. The high-pitched singing and squeaky clean lyrics have been replaced by interviews they conducted with teenage girls around the Los Angeles area. They discussed school, boys, hopes, fears, parents, friends. The result is an almost uncomfortably intimate look at the inner lives of six girls and a glimpse into youth culture without the Disney gloss. Each of the songs on Music for Sleeping Children takes its name from its subject. This is Isabel.
I've always been that girl from, like, there's always, you know how in like elementary school there's always the girl that has a really big crush? And I had a boyfriend like first 2 months into school, and it was a weird relationship, I admit. He was younger than me, and so it was kind of awkward. And also there's that thing that people say, like, girls mature faster than guys, so it was, I think for all the ninth graders I knew, most of the guys didn't want relationships. But for the older guys, like the 11th graders, I knew that that's pretty much what they were looking for. I actually dated one of them, and it turned into this really big drama.
Over the last decade, White has become increasingly interested in what he calls the late capitalist teenager, who has become both the primary object and audience in pop culture. White has studied this culture, and in response, has created all sorts of media. Teeny bopper photographs, films about teen ennui, after-school special cartoons, and dolls that eerily resemble real 13-year-olds. He held a casting call performance, in which he photographed 107 teens for a spot on a billboard. One was chosen. Later, he put out a call for girls who wished to talk about their lives into a microphone, and this was the beginning of Music for Sleeping Children.
The first young woman that we recorded was Sabrina, and she began as an open call for teenagers who would be interested. She had a great voice, and she was very clear and really had good communication skills and was very forthcoming with information, but that kind of made you have to make a certain type of track.
Yeah. The biggest challenge for me was just that. It was the order of the process of having the interviews first and then trying to take the best bits out of the interview that I felt really represented the girl's personality and tried to put the music behind it.
This is Sabrina.
I think my biggest fear is not realizing my dreams, kind of. My family has always been really expectant and everything. Like my mom, I'll bring home like maybe straight A's and just the one B, and she'll be like, "Why didn't you get a B there?" Like, okay, I have straight A's and everything else, and the one thing I notice is the one B. And then, so I've always been pressed to do really, really, really well, and that's kind of gotten into me.
I think part of the magic with the interviews is that a lot of these kids are speaking on these issues for the very first time.
Yeah.
They're hearing themselves talk about these things that they've internalized. You hear in their voice the wheels turning of them figuring out who they are.
And just the complete awkwardness of an adult male requesting to have a discussion with them about their life is in and of itself so completely unheard of, that it's not a school counselor.
Right.
So in some ways, I think the project from the outset, because the parents were present and we were in a sound studio and they came to the sound studio, was this large kind of bubble. Because all of the parents, because we experienced, all of the parents were willing to let their kids go as far into any of these subjects and use any language that they wanted to use.
Yeah.
A sound engineer is in the room, a musical artist and a visual artist are in the room. We're all, it's odd.
It's odd. And
I mean, I love that oddness. I like that tension.
Yeah.
And I have so many plans, and I need to get married, and we're going to have 4 kids, and I already have their names picked out. And then I have all these plans, and I want to help the world, and I want to save the world, and I want to change something. To think that I'm not going to realize that. I'm not going to be good enough to do that. I'm not going to get the grades, or I'm gonna mess one thing up, and then that one small thing is just gonna, it's gonna ruin my whole entire plan.
It's funny because each one of the girls that were interviewed touched upon at some point in the interview, they all touched upon the same problem from very different angles, either being hated or hating,
mm-hmm.
or staying outside of hatred.
Yeah.
But the kind of cruelty and unfairness of their age group.
Yeah. And the result of that was losing friends. They break up with friends at that age, which every single girl had that happen to them.
And the gap between, let's say, Georgia and who she was as a teenager, in all of her confidence and all of her sense of popularity, and strengthen her person or confidence in her person, still have the same problem. once the beat starts and she starts talking, you realize that the beat is following this 15-year-old's persona. Or sure. Is this 15-year-old's persona.
A lot of people say that I'm really popular, and it makes me happy, I guess. Well, I mean, it's high school. Of course you want to be popular, because, you know, you get more attention, you get, you know, people coming up to you, people wanting to be your friend. There used to be this group when I first came to my school. They were just really pretty, and they were very confident, and they just, like, walked around like they owned the school. But this year, no one notices them anymore. And I feel like me and my friends might have taken their place. A lot of people look up to us, and they're always like, oh, you guys are so pretty. You guys are, like, I guess really popular. It's, oh, Georgia, you're so popular.
Download the entire EP and watch videos of the songs at musicforsleepingchildren.com. This month, the impeccable Criterion Collection is releasing the 1958 horror cheese classic, The Blob, on Blu-ray, which I have no idea what Blu-ray is, but our two guests absolutely know exactly what Blu-ray is. They're J.M. Tyree and Ben Walters, who co-wrote a book for BFI Film Classics about The Big Lebowski, and they are each, in their own right, masterful film critics contributing to The Guardian UK, and we asked them to revisit The Blob.
It's indestructible. It's indescribable. Nothing can stop it.
This town is in danger.
How can it be stopped? Mob hysteria sweeps one city. Before long, the nation, and then the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of The Blob.
Starring Steve McQueen and a cast of exciting young people.
So, how would you explain this strange persistence of The Blob?
It is a strange persistence. It's a strange movie. It's not a very good movie.
You don't think so?
By conventional standards, it comes as part of this 50s sort of horror alien invasion cycle and sticks pretty closely to that formula. It's not especially high production values. It's not especially scary. Mm. But there's something about it that pulls you in. The main thing that pulls you in, literally, is the theme song by Burt Bacharach.
Right.
Beware of the blob. It creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch.
It's a jaunty theme tune for the end of the world.
Let's dance.
Let's dance. Well, so The Blob is a film about an alien invasion, about this little blob that arrives on Earth outside this small town. So as a meteorite lands, this little blob comes out. It just sort of sits there. An unfortunate passerby, farmer, prods it with a stick, and long story short, ends up getting eaten. And then the blob continues to eat its way through this town, going from this little blob of jello into a bigger blob of jello. I mean, that's pretty much what happens.
Dave! Doc Hallen's been killed.
Doc Hallen? What happened?
It's over at his place. You gotta come now.
Oh, wait a minute, Steve. Tell us what happened.
Well, I'm trying to tell you. Now, this thing had killed the doc.
But what was it?
Stop with it, kid. But it's kind of like a mass that keeps getting bigger and bigger.
But I mean, there is this sort of lineage, which I guess goes back to spiritualist ectoplasm in the 19th century, but the kind of the inhuman, amorphous, gloopy, sticky, slimy stuff. I mean, you see it in Ghostbusters as well. So I guess there's a sort of lineage there, but in The Blob, it's just not scary.
No.
I mean, there's all these lineages of, in horror movies, you have all these different traditions. You have, like, the sympathetic monster, the Frankenstein, the monster that you feel sorry for, or you have the Dracula, like the seductive, creepy, tantalizing, can't take your eyes off it, or you have, I mean, you do have like the H.P. Lovecraft, the obscene, sublime, the thing that's so big, so inhuman, to even gaze upon it is to go insane. Whereas here, it's pretty much blob lands, blob eats some more.
I mean, I think it's really the kind of movie that's sort of designed not to be watched. You know, it doesn't demand your full attention, so, you know, it wants you to go to the concession stand in the middle and get your Twizzlers, which really are basically like freeze-dried sections of blob.
Right. Right.
And, you know, maybe you're taking a breather from your makeout session, you know, in the theater or in the drive-in to glance up at the screen every once in a while. And the heroes of the movie are the kind of kids who go to drive-in movies.
Right.
To make out in their car. So the story is structured such that you can sort of not pay attention to it. But I think the movie does have virtues, like the color. We should talk about the use of color, right?
The color is really beautiful. For a film in 1958, it's not Technicolor, it's Deluxe, which is an alternative system, but it's still, the whole way through the movie, especially seeing it on this digital transfer, you can really see the thought, the effort that's gone into this really beautiful palette, which is really kind of poppy.
Well, I think you can watch The Blob with the sound off. And that might be a really great way to watch the movie, just marvel at the colors they use. They put so much thought into it. I mean, everything down to, like, the shade of the wallpaper in Annetta Corso's house. It's this absolutely lovely shade of lavender that you can just kind of look at and drool over. It's kind of like a pop art Vermeer, where you can see every little crease in the walls. And Steve McQueen's car, of course, is this larger-than-life sort of jaw-dropping color of cornflower blue.
And of course, goes with his beautiful blue eyes, which really do pop. Do we think the Blob has a place in the lineage of sort of 50s ambiguous social satire? Is the Blob, is it the Red Menace? Is it communism? Is it McCarthyism? Is it consumerist conformism? Or is it
just a blob?
Just a blob.
Sometimes a blob is just a blob.
Right.
Matt Frassica, who lives in Louisville, Kentucky, spoke with Alan Lomax's curator, Nathan Salzberg, who's also an excellent musician of the John Fahey tradition, about an incredible collection of records that Salzberg found in a dumpster in Louisville.
My name is Nathan Salzberg. I'm the curator of the Alan Lomax Archive. In late March 2010, I got a phone call from a friend here in Louisville that a friend of a friend had been on a dumpster job that afternoon and had brought home from that job a few boxes of 78 RPM records. Knowing that I have an interest in music of the 78 era, which is roughly the late teens and the early 40s, he called me and I was lying on the sofa, sort of not interested in going out that night. But I got up off the sofa and I drove over to the house, and there were maybe 8, 12, I can't remember now, 15 boxes of 78s on the floor and filled with, maybe, you know, 20, 25 78s a box. The stuff was never really built to last to begin with, and folks who bought the stuff often didn't hold on to it or didn't treat the records well, so they haven't survived. But I didn't have my hopes up, and I started looking, and right away I started seeing these names like, you know, Carter Family, Uncle Dave Macon, Jimmy Rogers, the big stars of the era. But as I kept going, I started seeing rarer and rarer records. And then I found a Mississippi John Hurt record. I mean, as a friend told me in the other room, I went pale and just said, we have got to go to this house. Like, we've got whatever, wherever the rest of these records are, we have to get them. We have to get them now. They had gotten the contract to clean out this house of a fellow whose name was Don Wall. And it was obvious that this guy had a considerable record collection of vernacular music from the 20s and 30s.
Please don't take my life. I got two little babies and a darling loving wife. That bad man.
So six of us piled into two cars. We drove out to Preston Highway on sort of the lip of the south end of Louisville. There was a full moon, and under the full moon, we dove into the dumpster, pulling out maybe 30 boxes of 78s. A friend of mine went in headfirst and came up with ketchup on his brow. There were all these bottles of family-sized ketchup in the dumpster. We weighed down two pickup trucks pretty well and then drove back to the house where my friends had been hanging out and proceeded to dig through some of the records. But apparently there were all these records left in the house. So I went home that night, and I slept a very fitful night's sleep. And I woke up at about dawn the next day and waited until a decent hour to call the dumpster guy. I think I called him around 8. And he said, by all means, come out to the house this afternoon, and anything you can take will be something we don't have to lug out. So that afternoon, I drive out to Preston Highway, and they let me in. They give me a dust mask, and I go downstairs, and the place is just a disaster. I mean, the guy just lives in squalor. And I just sit in carrying boxes up and just box after box after box after box upstairs. Things were coated in mold. I didn't have gloves on. My hands were just completely black. This was recorded in 1927 in Atlanta by a group called the Georgia Crackers, which was a couple of brothers named Paul and Leon Kofer and their friend Ben Evans, who played the guitar. And they were sons of a sawmill operator and also a hymnal compiler. And they learned their tunes, by and large, from their dad's sawmill men. Tony Russell, who really is sort of the world's expert of this stuff, had the very best description of this band, that he called them the sound of a band playing on the precipice of disintegration. When you hear a record like that, especially when you listen to country music from the 50s to the 70s, even outlaw music sounds like almost sounds like chamber music compared to that. I mean, that just sounds like it's totally hell for leather. It's like falling apart at the seams. They sound like they're racing to get the song in before the record ends. They know they only have about 3 minutes. Ultimately, we found the collection consists of, I guess there's about 2,500 items in what we call the Don Wall collection now. 99% of them are hillbilly records. So there's all of this just phenomenal and extremely rare string band material, all from all of these places, like, you know, rural Tennessee and Kentucky and Virginia and North Carolina. What's great about the recordings made in the 20s and 30s is they were often made, not always, but they were often made locally. There were field recording sessions set up, and it just flushed out all of these just phenomenal, really characteristic local artists that had local styles that sounded like where they were from. Donald Pickett Wall, 75, died March 23rd. He left behind a brother, two nephews, and a niece. Cremation was chosen, and there was no funeral.
I have heard of a land on a faraway strand, to the beautiful home of the soul.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Air France, the official carrier for Marseille-Provence 2013, European Capital of Culture. the region known
the job didn't pay that well. A lot of the best and brightest women in the country were teachers because they didn't have as many opportunities as they do now. Mm-hmm. When the feminist revolution opened up those opportunities, it was great news for women who became doctors and lawyers and radio show hosts, mm-hmm. on and on.
That's right.
But bad news for the classrooms. Well, see what you think of this idea.
All right.
This cascading.
Is this the hidden side? Is that where we're going?
This is so hidden.
All right,
this is so hidden.
All right.
This cascading that we're seeing now with the top pushing down, what it means is that it might be good news for a field like education, because more and more highly educated people, women and men, could end up working as, say, teachers or elsewhere in education. So this year, for instance, Teach for America, which recruits from elite college campuses, had the most applications in its 20-year history. It accepted only 17% of the applicants, which means that on some campuses, it's almost as hard to get into Teach for America as it was to get into the college itself. So if selectivity is any measure, that means that the core of potential teachers, at least, is drawn from a very, very talented pool.
All right. I think we could say silver lining found in a roundabout
way.
Stephen Dubner, freakonomics.com is the website. He's back in a couple of weeks. We'll see you, man.
Thanks for having me, Kai. Hey, podcast listeners. Next week on Freakonomics Radio, what do a bunch of medieval nuns...
The abbess with an heroic spirit took a razor and with it cut off her nose.
...have in common with Bo Jackson?
I said, you draft me if you want. You're going to waste a draft pick. I said, I promise you that.
Answer, they cut off their noses to spite their face. Next time on Freakonomics Radio, spite happens.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
Welcome to WHFR. I am the Diva, and I would love for you to allow me to add a little heat to your Monday nights. Please join me for Lyrical Infusion every Monday evening from 7 to 9 p.m., where I blend the lyrics with the melodies to create magical